call this meeting to order of the Investment Committee. Could we have a roll call?
Chair Carter?
Here.
Vice Chair Geddes?
Here.
Regent Arascata?
Here.
Regent Perkins? Regent Tarkanian? You have a quorum. Advisory members? Mr. Campbell? Mr. Garcia?
Russell Campbell is here.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Byrne? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have any public comment here in Las Vegas? Don't think we have any here. Do we have any in Reno?
There's no public comment in Reno.
And then would there be any online? No online public comment. Very good. So we'll move on to item number 2, minutes for possible action. Do I have a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
Motion from Regent Geddes, second from Regent Arascata. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. We'll move on to number 3, the chair's report. So I asked for Mr. Klinger and to come up with some different ways to look at how our portfolio is managed. And I think we've given a lot of runway to our current model. And so I wanted to look at the actual numbers for how much it's costing us, what our returns are, and then some possible other ways to manage that money. I don't intend on us making a motion for changing the full way we manage it today and when we get to item 4. What I would have you consider, though, to kind of frame up our discussion a little bit, is to first, if you have questions that you'd like answered so that you would be prepared to make that move in another month or so, that would give some time to staff to get that stuff together. And then second, if after hearing the data today, you feel like maybe we could let Russell Campbell go. I'm not Russell Campbell, Russell Investments. Go. The returns, as Mr. Klinger will show you, and the data there, I would entertain a motion to do that today. So no motion on actually making the full switch to any other new model or a different model, but if you feel like you'd like to move away from Russell Investments today, that would be fine. And then whatever questions that you would like for staff to put together so that we have a full understanding of all these different methods of managing the money. So we'll move on to item number 4, management of investment portfolios. Mr. Klinger.
Thank you, Chair Carter. Good morning, committee members. For the record, Andrew Klinger, Chief Investment Officer, Chief Investment Officer, Chief Financial Officer for the Nevada System of Higher Education. I would ask if you could please bring up the PowerPoint. So we have a short PowerPoint presentation, and as Chair Carter indicated, he had asked us to bring some information to the committee on just how we are currently structured with the OCIO model, look at some of the alternatives out there, and we specifically, and you'll see it as we go through the presentation this morning, we really looked at 3 specific instances of other examples of how investment pools are managed. We looked at the 2 foundations, the Foundation for UNR and UNLV, and then we also looked at PERS and just how they're structured and how they manage their funds. Theirs is a little bit different because they're managing $46 billion, so it's a little bit different, but still, nonetheless, I think it's impressive what they do with the small staff that they have. And before I jump in, I'd like to just thank my staff, who in the last month has put a lot of time into gathering the information that they have gathered so far. Tillery Williams, who's our analyst who worked on this, Rhett Vertrese, my assistant CFO, and then Julia Teska, my budget director. All three of them worked on it. So I want to thank them just for their time putting into this. And then want to apologize to the committee for dumping a 232-page supplemental packet on you a couple of days or maybe even a day before the committee meeting. We were frantically trying to get the best information together that we could. And so, and that's why I think in discussions with the chair, we would prefer a little more time to explore some of the alternatives, because there's still some questions that we have outstanding just based on our research and based on the work that we've done so far. So next slide, please. So today I'll just talk a little bit about our current model and what fees we pay for that service. So we have, I think as everyone knows, we have two vendors essentially that are our OCIOs, Cambridge and Associates and Russell Investments. And then we'll look at the two foundations, and we should have folks on the line as well, staff from the foundations that can answer more specific questions about how they staff their organizations. But again, we looked at both UNR and UNLV. And then we did reach out to NACUBO, that's the National Association of Business Officers, essentially, and they did a study in 2020 of endowments, and there's some data in there, I think, that's relevant about how endowments of our size and larger, those that manage it with an OCIO and those that manage it in-house. And then finally, we'll just talk about what it would take, we think, and again, this is very preliminary and we'd like more time to dig into it, but what we think it would take for us to bring it in-house and manage in-house. Okay, next slide, please. So this is an estimate of the OCIO fees that we pay, and you can see the different time periods there. And again, we have Cambridge and Associates as one of our OCIOs, and then Russell Investments. So for Cambridge and Associates, the management fees based on this data here is estimated about $377,000. Next slide, please. So when you look at Russell Investments, the numbers here are not exactly apples to apples, because the Russell Investment number does include their sub-advisor fees as well, which are all bundled together. So it's a little bit, it's not exactly an apples-to-apples comparison. So when you see the difference between Cambridge's 377 and their 665, that is because the number for Cambridge does not include the investment advisor fees, which are identified separately. But in this case, the way the Russell Investment contract is structured, it's bundled together. So their fees are the $665,886. Next slide. So the first item you see here is, so again, we reached out to the two foundations on just how they manage their investments, because neither of them use the same structure that we use. They don't use an OCIO model. So they, you know, they have staff in-house, and they also contract with investment advisors. And so you can see here the allocation of time that they provided to us of staff that work on the investment management piece for each of them. And so for the UNR Foundation, the staff cost for them is the $134,000. If you go to the next slide. On the next slide, you can see the other costs, the investment consultants that they use, the legal services and other consultants that they use. And so all in, when you look at the UNR Foundation, the total cost for them to manage it in-house plus the consultants that they do pay, it's about $393,000. Now, as of December 31st, so our endowment right now, the Inchi endowment is about $312 million. When you look at the UNR Foundation, and this was as of December 31st, so they obviously have updated information, but they had an endowment of about $245 million. So very similar in size to the Inchi endowment. Next slide, please. This is just some additional data that the UNR Foundation provided to us on just some of the specifics about you know how they manage their funds. They have approximately 40 investments. I think we have 80, if I remember correctly. And so just a much different structure than what they have. And this is just some estimates on what it takes them internally to manage that. I don't want to go through each one of the bullet points on here unless there are specific questions. And again, we have them on the line as well if you want to dig more into the details on how they are managing it and just some of the specifics. Next slide, please. So here's the UNLV Foundation, and again, very similar. They're using a portion of various positions to manage theirs in-house. So you can see based on those estimates from the UNLV Foundation, it's a total of $367,000 in salaries and benefits for the positions that are listed there. Next slide, please. And then some of the other costs, again, some of the consultants and other fees that they pay. And so you can see there when you look at, again, the total cost of in-house staff plus the consultants, you can see a total cost there of $527,000. And UNLV, the UNLV Foundation as of December 31st last year was about $290 million. So again, obviously that's grown since then as well, but again, similar in size to the Inchi endowment. Next slide, please. So again, we reached out to Nakubo, who conducted a study in 2020 looking at universities and just how they manage their endowments. And I think just some of the highlights from that survey, 41% of those who responded to the survey indicated that they use an OCIO model. 43%, if you look at endowments between 250 and 500, which we sort of fall right on the line. You could either compare us to the 100 to 250 or the 250 to 500, because we're just right over that $250 million mark at the 312. So 43% in that 250 to 500 utilize an OCIO. If you drop down into the tier below that, the 100 to 250, it's 56% of those who responded to the survey use an OCIO model. And on average, those schools reported about $1.96 million in total fees, which is less than what we are currently paying under our current structure with our two OCIOs. At least looking at the averages, I'm sure there are those within that survey that are at the same level we are. But on average, that number is less than what we're paying. It's 0.56% of the total endowment value, and ours again is somewhat higher than that. And then just again, some of the other statistics on here. I don't need to go through each one of these lines, but just wanted to give you a sense and an idea of some national data on how we compare to other institutions and how they are managing their endowments. So I think the takeaway here is that depending on which range you want to look at, either 43% of schools who responded or 56%, depending on what range you're in, use the current model that we're using. The others are managing those funds in-house. Next slide, please. Just some of the other data on this, again, just looking at the various sizes and total fees. And again, on average, $756,000 in fees if you're looking at the 100 to 250 range. And again, the percentage of that fee is pretty close. It was 0.56 on the other one. It's 0.52 here. So very similar in fees, as, you know, across the survey as you look at it. Next slide, please. So Ken Redd from Nakubo is who helped us put this information together, and I think just some important points for the committee to consider today and in the future as we talk about this. The number one reason that schools switched, according to Ken, is the cookie cutter approach that OCIOs take. The other points there are that schools with larger endowments, and ours is relatively small compared to other institutions, they want more control over how they invest the funds, which lets them then customize their strategies. And really, probably in those cases, you can be, I would argue, you can probably be more nimble in those cases. But again, I think there are trade-offs when you look at this. There are pros and cons, and I think that's you know, some of the information that we would like to pursue as we look at this is digging into sort of the unknown of this, right? I mean, what I don't want to do is recommend to the committee this change, and then we get into it, and then there are some unknown costs where I have to come back and say, okay, we gave you this estimate of staff, but we also have these other costs that are going to be associated with it. So I think that's part of the reason for wanting to spend a little more time with this and do a little more research. Because again, as we've dug into it, I think there have been some good questions raised that we just want to pursue, and we don't have answers to exactly yet, but thought it was good to share with the committee just some of the initial information that we have been able to put together, and just to give you a high level of some of the comparisons. Next slide, please. So the other question about bringing it in-house is your ability to hire an in-house chief investment officers. I mean, as you can imagine, in that industry, in particular, if you work in the private sector, the upside on those salaries can be very significant. And as an institution of higher education and a public institution of higher education, I certainly don't think we're in the position to pay, you know, some of the salaries that might be demanded based on that. Now, with that said, if you go to the next slide, I think it's the PERS information. With that said, PERS does manage a $46 billion investment, and they essentially currently do it with one chief investment officer. Now, they obviously have consultant agreements as well. You can see there on the bottom bullet, they spent $756,000 on consultants to help them manage it. But they pay, they just asked for a new position, so they will now have a chief investment officer plus an assistant chief investment officer, and what they had asked for as a salary for that position would be a base salary of $189,000 plus benefits. So you can see there in the top table just what those salaries might look like. So for us, I think if the decision down the road was to move this in-house, we really would be looking, from a salary standpoint, we would be looking something more similar to what PERS has. I think that would be more in line with, I just think, what the expectations from probably the board would be, as well as legislature and others as they are looking at our budget. So the question then becomes, well, how hard is it to go out and find somebody to do this type of work with the type of expertise that you need How difficult is it to find those individuals that we could bring in-house for that type of salary, knowing that it's a very competitive market when you're looking at the private sector and comparing it to that? And I just don't know the answer to that today, and I think that's another piece of this that we would like to explore is, okay, if we had a position at this level of salary and it was a chief investment officer position, what would the recruitment like? What's the pool of possible candidates that would come forward? And I just at this point in time, I just don't have enough information to know what would be possible with that. Next slide. Again, just some high level information here on what PERS does. They have a very small staff. I mean, I don't know. We didn't do the research to compare them to other public retirement systems, but certainly when you're looking at a $46 billion investment and they essentially do it with a very small staff, and you can see there just the rates of return that they have experienced over a 10-year period, and then in the last 5 years, you know, a little under 10%, and then a little over 10% in the past 5 years. And they do that again. Up until this point, they have done it with one chief investment officer and consultant contracts. So it is certainly possible to bring this in-house. It's just, again, there's still some unanswered questions for us that we would like to explore more. Next slide. So for us, and again, this is really using PERS as sort of the model of how we would structure it. We think we would need two in-house staff, a chief investment officer and a deputy slash assistant chief investment officer. And again, using the same salaries that PERS is using, we think that would, you know, that internal cost would be about $410,000. Now, obviously, we would still have or would need to have consultant agreements with investment advisors as well. And if we don't have an OCIO, we would still need that outside investment advisor expertise. And so you would have those costs as well that would have to be built into this. And, you know, and some of the feedback that we received from the OCIOs, and again, I think this is another piece of information that we would like to explore more. One of the things that they have indicated is that they are able to negotiate discounts from some of the fund managers on their fees. And so what is the offset of that? If we're not able to negotiate those discounts, you know, that's one of those costs that, again, as you go through it, it's sort of this hidden cost that you don't want to be surprised with later if you do make that shift. Next slide, please. So I think as Chair Carter had indicated, we wrote this up, the agenda item up originally with the idea that we would be prepared to make a specific recommendation today, one way or the other. But again, I think after discussions with my staff and just the additional questions that have come up, we're not prepared today to make a recommendation. We think we probably need about another 30 days to complete our research. But we did write it up in a way that you could take the various actions that are listed there on the screen. You could ask us to go out for an RFP to potentially hire a new OCIO. You could terminate one or both of the contracts for our current OCIOs. Ask us to begin the process of transferring the investments in-house. And then finally, probably our recommendation is the last bullet on there, is to ask us to continue to do some research and look at the information and then give any feedback that you have today on additional information that you would like to see us bring back in the future as you consider this decision moving forward. And I think that is the last slide. Next slide. And again, we do have both of our OCIOs on the line as well, who I'm sure would appreciate the opportunity to to chime in on this consideration as well.
CFO Klinger, I have one more question for you. I'm not sure which page it's on, if you could guide us, but you have the results comparison between Russell and Cambridge over, what is the three-year span?
Yeah, Chair Carter, for the record, Andrew Klinger. Yeah, and we did send out, it went out this morning, an updated information on that that shows the comparison of the endowment returns for the two OCIOs as well as the legacy assets through May 31st. And I don't have that in front of me. I was going to pull it up on my computer, but I need to log into it. But I believe what it shows is that, and I guess for the committee's clarification on that, both the OCIOs started in 2017 with $110 million. So that the endowment was split at that time between the two, and they were each given $110,000. And so when you're looking at it, today, I think that the simplest view of this is, you know, because obviously this can get very complicated with fees and rates of return and all that. But I think a very simplistic way to look at this is to look at that chart that was sent out this morning and say, okay, they both started with 110. Cambridge is now sitting at 144.9 million through 531. And Russell is sitting at 126.6. And again, they both started at the same point in time. And so for Cambridge, that is an annualized rate of return of 10.4. And for Russell, that's an annualized rate of return for 7.8. And then we also have the legacy assets in there, which have obviously performed very well with a rate of return of 14.1%. And so I think it gives you a good snapshot comparison of the two OCIOs that we have. And, you know, we went back and did the research when this was first approved and looked at, okay, why did we select two OCIOs at the time? Because I don't know that that's normally what's done. And I think the answer when we looked at it was that it would give the committee an opportunity to evaluate the performance of the two OCIOs, and it would give you, and it wouldn't put all of our investments in one basket, so to speak. So it would split it between the two. Well, here we are almost 4 years later, and you can see, again, from a very simplistic view of just how the two compare to how, and that's net of fees as well, I should say. So I think that's what you were looking for, Chair Carter.
Yes, that is the supplemental material. I didn't know if it was in the other document as well, but that's exactly it. So it's $18 million different from Cambridge to Russell Investments. So do you want to start maybe with some questions from the committee, and then we go – well, actually, let's reverse that. Do you want to go to Russell Investments and Cambridge first for their feedback or comments? Anybody from Cambridge?
Sure. Hi, I'm happy to jump in. For the record, Wendy Walker from Cambridge Associates. Thank you for the chance to speak. It's been my honor to serve NSHE for close to a decade now. You were my first client when I joined Cambridge Associates. And I served the system, including under the prior advisory mandate, when we recommended the private investment funds that have indeed been performing so exceptionally over these past few years since we shifted into an OCIO mandate. I'm proud of our results that we've delivered to the system over the past, it's now 4 years and 2 months. We are ahead of our benchmark for that overall period modestly. But we've really gained momentum as our private investments program has become a larger and larger part of the portfolio. For the fiscal year to date, we now, through the end of March, we're sitting at a 30.6% return, and that's 4.5 percentage points ahead of our benchmark. I'll note that private investments are still held at December 31st, 2020, valuations. So both the legacy asset sleeve and now more than 10% of the Cambridge Associates managed sleeve currently are held with a 0% return for the past 5 months, and they should boost overall results when reported. If I had to guess at the magnitude of how much these preliminary results will increase, right now preliminary or very early March private investment results are coming in very similar to the fourth quarter of 2020, when legacy assets delivered a 20% return and private investments within CA managed assets delivered an 11% return. Our private investment funds are less mature than those in the legacy assets, and so they aren't throwing off the same level of returns that we would expect in later years. So directionally, we would expect legacy assets to go from what we see fiscal year to date is 31% return. When we have over 6 months, when we have two more quarters of results, I think that could very easily approach the high 40s, if not 50s, return. Cambridge managed assets, since private investments are still a smaller percentage, only about 11% as we're growing towards the 30% target, we would just expect probably another few percentage points added to our 30.6% return for the fiscal year to date. One other point occurred to me as we heard Mr. Klinger providing his presentation, and we agree there's a lot to consider. Our model in which we serve our clients is entirely customized. We have partnered and served NSHE for over 30 years now. So while my service dates back a decade, I have colleagues with institutional memory back a decade before that. And that was under an advisory model. And we very regularly help our clients transition into an in-house investment office. Now, typically, it's with much larger pool sizes before they decide to transition to an in-house investment staff. And that's in contrast to just a consulting or advisory relationship. But we stand ready to do that. And we customize the portfolio. And I should emphasize that NSHE owns every single manager relationship in this portfolio. There are no commingled products managed by Cambridge Associates. So if at any point NSHE decides to take assets in-house or to another provider, NSHE has the optionality to keep any fund manager relationships that they wish to keep. We also, our customization of our portfolios for each client allows us to emphasize the and support the strategic goals around NSHE's commitment to sustainability and diversity, equity, and inclusion. As a couple of anecdotes, just within the last 2 weeks, we got an announcement from a fund that we invested in on an early stage venture capital fund that we invested in on behalf of NSHE, called Urban Innovation Fund. It's led by two women, which is unique because women represent fewer than 2% of venture capitalists in this country. One of their portfolio companies, which is a software solution to power electric vehicle fleets, it was just acquired by Ford at a 25 times cash return on their initial investment in just over a year of them holding it. So NSHE's investment, which was made about a month ago when we made the commitment, and she will already receive a distribution of about 60% of the overall fund size based on this one single sustainability-oriented investment. And we have boots on the ground in multiple continents looking for these sorts of ideas that we think will enhance the system's strategic priorities as well as drive strong returns. The committee may also remember that at the last meeting, there was an approval to become a founding investor in Metis, which is an African-American woman-led asset manager, to become a founding investor in their passive U.S. equity fund. Just wanted to circle back with an update that investment has been completed. Metis will publicly recognize the system as a founding investor. and will be hosting a video conference for like-minded investors that any investment committee members or system staff members are invited to attend for interaction, a discussion of diversity in investments, value add. And Meta staff is also available to speak with board or committee meetings or with staff about diversity and investments. So we'll continue to seek ideas that will support not only the system's strong financial objectives, but also other strategic objectives that reflect the mission and the values of the institution.
Thank you. Russell Investments? Do we have somebody from Russell Investments?
Good morning. This is Matt Beardsley. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, yes.
Good. Okay, excellent. Good morning. This is Matt Beardsley from Russell Investments. I'm one of the directors of Investment Solutions here, and I'm the primary contact and have been on the INSEE relationship since we began that in late 2016, early 2017. Good morning. Thank you for having me. Really glad to have an opportunity to talk to you folks today. You know, I wanted to maybe just give a few remarks about performance. I recognize that the longer term results have been, I'm going to call it a little bit challenged relative to the policy benchmark, but I am pleased to say that, you know, on an absolute basis, they've been relatively strong and certainly ahead of the long-term economic objective that INSEE has set. So, you know, one of the things that I would say is that, you know, when you hire an OCIO, there is a implicit portion of that decision that is, you know, discretion is given to the OCIO to make investment decisions on your behalf. And I think what you're seeing in the longer-term results from Russell is reflective that we've been making active decisions. Some of those don't always go the way we'd like them to, at least not initially. And so what we had happen is as we started to think about where we were in the economic and financial market cycle in 2018, we started to position the portfolio a bit more towards value stocks. And that proved to be very early in the cycle. Notwithstanding what happened with the COVID kind of market drawdown last year, even in 2018, we saw equity markets as being pretty overvalued. And so we started to position away from the high-flying growth names and towards value. And that was actually proved to be a little bit early. And so our results on a relative basis, benchmark relative basis, were hampered. But I would say that if you look at what's gone on over the last, let's call it 6 to 9 months, I think that thesis, that investment thesis that Russell had been positioning for is starting to come around and be rewarded. If you look at the trailing 3 months, trailing 12 months, our portfolio has been up, you know, in the low, or forgive me, the high 20, or forgive me, almost 30% range. Let me pull up the number here specifically. Fiscal year to date, the portfolio is up 26.7% through the end of May, about 3% ahead of the benchmark. Over the trailing year, it's up 29.4%, again, about 3% ahead of the benchmark. Last 3 months, we've added about 2% of value versus the benchmark. So we're starting to see that value thesis start to pay off. We're very happy about that. You know, it's been a little bit long in the tooth, and obviously it's a bit challenging, as I said earlier, to see those initial results. But we think that over a full market cycle, which we're not that far off, but I would think over the next year or so, we would expect that this portfolio to really start to continue to produce good results, deliver the outcomes that we were expecting. A couple of points maybe in difference that I would say relative to the team at Cambridge. Russell has, I think, generally speaking, a very similar philosophy, but the way we've built your portfolio over the last 4+ years is that we've been largely in listed securities, public securities. We've not had any real private securities to speak of. Much of that was to do with the fact that as we began the program, the allocation that would have been permissible for the total portfolio's allocation limits was relatively small in terms of the amount that Russell would have been able to deploy. And so we had not begun that program because it was, I'm going to call it economically unfeasible to build a custom portfolio at sub $1 million. We're probably closer to the point of being able to do that now, but that was a reason why we didn't introduce that into your portfolio. So we've leaned pretty heavily on listed securities, both equities and bonds, over this time frame. So that was an element that I guess if you look at it in retrospect, there was an opportunity lost because private markets have done pretty well. If you look at our portfolio performance for our private markets clients that have that in their portfolio, they've done well. So a bit of an allocation change that had an implication to returns. Also, one thing to maybe note a little bit is within our diversifiers portfolio, the hedge fund portfolio, we have purposely made that relatively non-linked to movements in equity and bond markets. We've tried to keep it relatively market neutral. And as a result, we've probably not participated as strongly as much of the rest of the hedge fund community, which have leaned more heavily into equity market beta. And so I would say we're relatively content with the longer-term absolute returns of that part of the portfolio, but on a relative basis, we certainly have not held up as well as we'd like, given that the peers have used a lot more equity market returns than we have. Long story short, I would say that, you know, the outcome is coming our way. I think we've seen results that are starting to improve materially. I'm very pleased by that. We continue to be constructive on the economy, all told. We think we positioned well for that for a continued economic reflationary period. The portfolio has more gearing towards value, smaller cap, foreign stocks at this stage, because we think those are all still poised to do very well as the globe recovers from this COVID kind of pandemic. So I'll draw a line under it there. I would like to say that results have gotten to the point where we're actually doing the job that Ninchi hired us for. Longer term, we could continue to improve on those, and we will do. But we're starting to see a bit of a turn of the page and the results that we'd like to see. Any questions that I can answer from the committee at this point?
Well, we'll take questions in just a moment, but I'd like to hear from Mr. Campbell as well.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Good morning. You can hear me? Okay.
Oops. We can hear you, but we have quite the echo. Maybe your speakers are on or something.
I turned off my phone, so hopefully you can hear me.
Okay.
My system is a little unstable this morning, so can you hear me now?
It's very, very low.
Okay, let me see if I can go up further. Does that make any difference?
That's much better.
Okay. So apparently if I control my volume, it helps you here. All right. I would just like to make 2 points apropos of Mr. Klinger's very good presentation. The first is I'd say that UNLV and UNR are similar size to the NG Foundation. PERS, of course, is much larger. So, you know, these are points of similarity and points of difference. But I would argue that the NG Foundation is actually much more complex than any of those three. PERS is much larger, but largely invested in public investments, whereas NG over the years has accumulated a number of much more complex investments. We have the legacy portfolio, which is a significant amount of money with ongoing obligations. Cambridge just indicated that we own the managers, and roughly 10% of their portfolio, so roughly $14 million, is invested in private investments. We would continue to own those post any changes, whether we went OCIO or in-house. So and then we've got these recent initiatives with respect to climate change and also racial equity. So I would argue that the NG portfolio is extremely complicated and should be taken under consideration. Second point I'd make is that the trend is towards OCIO, as indicated in Andrew Klinger's fine presentation. Small endowments struggle, nationwide with managing the complexity of the current environment. Some of the things I just mentioned about private equity and racial equity and climate change are examples of that. It's not as stark a difference should we be with an OCIO or should we be in-house? I think if the objective here, and it really should be better performance, I think there is a variety of ways of getting there that aren't just necessarily saying, yes, OCIO, no OCIO, yes, in-house, no in-house. I think there's a blend, there's a variety of different ways to go. And so I encourage Andrew Klinger to do further research. I think that's the best solution for today.
And then lastly, if the UNLV Foundation or UNR Foundation wants to add anything or thoughts on Mr. Klinger's presentation. I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I don't have blue jeans to see who might be waving or anything there. But if a UNLV Foundation or UNR Foundation would like to speak, please do so. Okay. So then I guess questions from the board then towards what information they would need to have to be able to make a decision, or if you feel comfortable with keeping Russell Investments for right now, or possibly terminating Russell Investments, whatever comments you might have, whoever wants to start us off.
Chair Cart.
Yes, Regent Geddes.
Thank you. I have just a couple of observations and then some data requests in order for us to make those decisions. First one is, we trended to the OICO for a long time because of our staff issues. We had small staff. We had trouble keeping staff in there. We went through budget cuts, cutting the staff. And as you know, the system office is staring at a 12% budget cut again. And I honestly don't know how we would even come up with those salaries at this point in time to pay that. So that's a concern to me. And as a follow-up question to that, to Andrew, is there any data about how big the actual staffs are in those other institutions that you could get from the national organization? Because, we always talk about how small our system staff is, and we're very small compared to most other public agencies, and it seems like staffing could be an issue beyond the budget cut. So I'd kind of like to know for those other organizations how much they have. I know you had the ones for in-state, but if we could get numbers on the national side of it, I'd be really interested in that. One of the other key reasons we moved to the OICO model is that there's 13 of us elected regents, and very few of us have any financial knowledge whatsoever. We get lucky when we get a Davidson in the building, and his portfolio was bigger than ours. But when we look at the advisory board that we created, we brought Mr. Campbell on to help give us financial expertise in that advisory role. And just recently, we added the chairs of the UNR and UNLV Foundation, Mr. Garcia and Mr. Byrne. And I think the UNR and UNLV Foundation have a lot more financial experts on their foundations. Not only the chairs, but they have finance committees, and most of them have finance expertise that most of us don't. So if we want to look at the OICO model going down the road, I would ask that we look at a much bigger advisory board. So it's more than these three people, where maybe we can, get 6, 10, 15 financial experts who can advise us, because that was one of the big reasons going down that path. So also looking at some of these bigger endowments or that national data is, do they have financial advisory boards to help them out? And that's one of our concerns going forward, was how do we manage this ourselves with our budgets and our financial knowledge? So I'd like more data on those as we go down that path. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Regent Ariscotta, did you have something, or is that for new business?
That was for new business, but Regent Geddes did a great job on a lot of the questions that I know that I had also. The current two staffs that are managing these portfolios, what is the total number between both staffs combined?
Chair Carter to Regent Ariscotta, are you talking about the two OCIOs? So when you look at, and I actually have their fees here, so when you look at Russell Investments, and so what I presented was their management fees, which again includes their sub-advisor fees. But if you look at the fees in total So it would be the investment management fees, what they call incentive fees, which are incentives for the fund managers, and then fund expenses. So for Russell Investments for calendar year 20, it was a little over $1 million. For Cambridge and Associates, and there, and again, theirs is a little bit different model. When you look at the OCIO fees and their other management fees and incentive fees for calendar year 20, for the Cambridge and Associates managed assets, it was a little over $2 million. And for the legacy assets, $677,000. So all in, and again, these include fund management fees and other fees that you're going to pay regardless. So when you look at it all in, you know, it's $3.7 million. And if Wendy or Matt Beardsley have any additional comments on that, happy to let them chime in.
Sure, I'm happy to pose just a couple of reactions. I haven't looked at the exact Nakubo data on the annual fees, but I would be interested to confirm whether or not the Nakubo data does include incentive fees, which tend to vary year by year. So as context, for the Cambridge Associates incentive fees paid to underlying managers, that was quite high in calendar year 2020 as a result of the very strong results that these managers generated. So just to be clear, the annual management fees are static year over year, but the incentive fees just depend on the manager performance. So for example, the highest incentive fee paid from the Cambridge portfolio in calendar year 2020 was to a manager that delivered a 45% return to NSHE's bottom line, and that was net of their annual management fee and their share of the calendar year 20 gains. So as always, the devil is sort of in the details in some of these comparisons, so we would just want to make sure to circle up with NSHE staff and get that right. And if I also heard the question, I think there was a question about staff levels, and just as context, Cambridge Associates has more than 1,000 employees worldwide, of which more than 100 are senior investment manager research professionals located on 4 continents. So what NSHE is paying for as part of our platform is boots on the ground, seeking out, trying to identify and access and negotiate favorable fees and terms on behalf of NSHE.
Good morning, this is Matt Beardsley. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Good morning. Okay, excellent, good. Well, let me follow up from the Russell Investment side. One thing I wanted to maybe make a bit clearer, the way that Russell has historically contracted with NSHE in regards to fees was on a bundled basis, but this week I provided, I guess it was late last week, I provided a pricing model that looks very much like the Cambridge model, where there is a static OCIO fee, and then the remainder of the costs are variable based on the underlying sub-advisors that Russell hires on the behalf of NSHE. So I believe Rhett and Andrew have that in hand. So if the regents want to look at that, you'll find that it'll be a little bit more of an apples to apples comparison, if that is of use to you. And as Wendy said, I think it's important. The incentive fees are going to vary. They will only get paid when the managers have success, and that's an important element of the consideration. So, we did have some managers on the hedge fund side that did earn those incentive fees over calendar year 2020. But if they don't outperform, they're not going to earn an additional bite of the apple, if you will, just because they didn't do the job they were meant to. But anyway, if there's anything on that I can follow up on, please let me know. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions of Regents or Regent Perkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general comment. Over and over again, I've heard it's not like comparing apples, it's like comparing apples to oranges. I think that would help me immensely if we were comparing apples to apples. Like maybe the structure could be the fees that are static, and then have another column that tells me if there was bonuses or contractual agreements that made it a little bit more, that would make it so much easier to look at and make a valid judgment.
Thank you. Any other comments before I ask a couple questions? Okay, CFA Oklinger, the one thing we haven't talked about is the operating pool and the ability to also use some of that in-house staff to guide us in the performance of that. Would you want to add a couple statements about that or what the benefit might be?
Sure. Regent Carter, for the record, Chief Financial Officer Klinger. I will point out as well, because we currently manage that under a more traditional, client advisor relationship, and that is Cambridge and Associates. So they are our advisor on the operating pool. And I think one thing that the committee might want to consider, and I know it was discussed back in 2016, when we converted to the OCIO model, is you could take the long-term portion of the operating pool and potentially bundle it with an OCIO as well. But if we did bring it in-house, certainly having a chief investment officer and an assistant, if that was the way we went, that would certainly, I think, benefit the operating pool as well.
And just so we know the numbers on that, where do you know where the operating pool sits at right now, value-wise?
The operating pool varies on a daily basis, but it's typically between 750 and 800 million, and that's all funds in. That's not just the long-term portion of it. That's the it's broken into three tranches: the long-term, medium-term, and short-term. So it's a relative to the endowment. It is a much larger pool of funds.
True. Thank you. Any other questions from anyone? So I think we have some good questions and some feedback and some more data we can get to hopefully move forward and make a decision here in the next month or two. We'll move on to item number 5, new business. Regent Ariscotta.
Thank you, Chair Carter. One of the items, with this being the investment committee and items that we have and will continue to put money into, I just feel that it is our responsibility to maintain an eye on the finances that are being spent and the finances are going in. Quite similar to what we have in just the presentation by CFO Klinger. I just feel that with the investments that we've had, over $400 million of capital construction projects over the past 5 years, and there have been significant overruns. And with those overruns, some of those finances to cover the overruns have had to come from the investments, the endowments, the other funds that each entity has in their back pocket. So what I'm asking for is that the Board of Regents and staff initiate a policy that at the minimum, one region acts as a point of contact to remain updated with the cost of construction following the approval of allocated resources. In this day and age, and the finances that are, and the belts that are being tightened, and the finances that are being trickled down, it's important that we have a financial responsibility and provide complete transparency for the investments placed. So on that stated, if they could be updated quarterly, if they, as the regent, can be updated quarterly on capital construction, the initial cost and the actual cost, I think it'll be beneficial for the system.
Very good. Thank you. Any other new business? Seeing none, do we have any public comment in Las Vegas? I don't see any. Do we have any public comment in Reno?
There's no public comment.
Any online public comment? No. So this meeting's adjourned.